morning, everybody. My name is Jack.
Hi, Jack.
I'm a grateful, active, enthusiastic member of the Al-Anon family groups, and I love my mother-in-law. especially since she's become a member of the Al-Anon family groups also. I'm really glad to be here. I want to thank the committee for their invitation to come and spend a little time with you folks and for your very kind hospitality. Everybody's been very nice. I'm really excited to be here this weekend. I have enough trouble with my ego already without walking into a room to do a talk with sold out signs on every door. It'll take a while to get over that. I'll go back and tell my home group about it and they'll say, "Were you gone?" So it's okay. I'm here in the company of some people I greatly admire in AA and Al-Anon, some terrific speakers. Matter of fact, if you're staying the weekend and going to get to hear all the speakers, at some point this weekend you'll get to hear my all-time favorite AA speaker. There are four of them here, and if they're in the room now, each one of them is sure that they're the one I'm talking about. And so, I'm not all well. I'm going to tell you right now, before the weekend's over, I will tell each one of them in secret that they're the one. Some great folks. My wife is an Omaha native, and we took this opportunity to come in a couple days early. We flew into Omaha and spent a couple of days with her family and lounged around the pool and went and did some stuff and had a good time. And we're going to stay a few days after the conference and head over to a meeting that we're particularly fond of in Bellevue on Tuesday night. We're driving across country from Omaha yesterday, and I'm admiring the scenery and this beautiful green pastures and foliage and everything that I pointed out to my wife. She explained to me how each one of those things was better back across the bridge on the Nebraska side. That meant the cattle, the corn, the drivers, everything that we covered, basically. And I thought we better get to the bottom of that, so we dissected it a little bit. I was just being a service there in the car. And what we found out is, after we talked about it a little bit, is that back when she drank and drove, which she was the designated driver and a blackout drinker, so she didn't think that counted, was that when she traveled on the Iowa side, that the police cars over here are unmarked with little secret lights in the grill, and she kept getting popped because she couldn't see them coming. So we got to the basis. I got to be of service and help her get to the bottom of an institutional resentment. Those are the hardest ones to deal with. So that's what it was. It wasn't about you, very kind folks in Iowa. It was, unless any of you are unmarked police car drivers, and you can line up after the meeting for her to personally make amends to you all. This is a lot of fun. I'll be having more fun after this is over. My favorite thing isn't standing at a microphone. It's sitting in the front row taking notes, because that's where I figure I need to be. But people keep asking me to step up here and do a little bit of talking and tell you where I came from. I think it's partially important because I'm a minority in Al-Anon. I'm a man in Al-Anon. There are not many of us. I don't know why it is that I got here and got to stay here. I don't know why it is that my ego was able to be put down just enough that I could come here and hear some similarities rather than decide that I was better than, or that I didn't need what you folks had, or that I was too different to get any benefit, that I got to come and stay at Al-Anon. Part of it probably has to do with some of the story I'm about to tell you. I'll tell you a little bit about where I came from and what happened and how I got here. First, I want to tell you that because of the grace of God and good sponsorship and the 12 steps that AA so graciously lent to the Al-Anon family groups, that it has been unnecessary for me to bring my drunken wife, my drunken girlfriend, home to meet the wife since February the 19th of 1990. And nobody in this room is happier about that than my beautiful wife, Leslie, who's accompanying me, and I'd like to introduce you to her. She's here in the front row. You stand up so they can see who you are. I like bringing her along because after you get a look at her, you understand maybe why I went through some of the insanity to get here. She's my visual aid in the front row, but she also doesn't look as dangerous as she turned out to be eventually. She was the alcoholic that got me here, and it wasn't her drinking, it was her sobriety that did it. Drinking couldn't have got me here. I grew up in a pretty wild and woolly family with a lot of adventures. We grew up in an area where gang fights and gun fights were just a customary pastime during the weekend, and that was just inside the family. And there's an adventure I'll share with you that's kind of a favorite story of mine about when I finally got old enough to move out of that house. Both of my folks, by the way, I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. I very much appreciated what Johnny had to say about the disease of alcoholism. He talked about the family disease of alcoholism when he was describing growing up in that alcoholic home last night. He did a terrific job of it. I grew up in a home very similar to that, with the possible exception of the fact that my parents didn't have the decency to drink and allow me to later explain some of my behaviors. And I puzzled over that for a while after I came to Al-Anon, until I came to the conclusion that both of my parents are adult children of alcoholics. That I came to you folks just sick and crazy and insane with my hat on backwards and my hair on fire for the very same reason that I grew up in a house that very much resembled what Johnny talked about last night with all of the behaviors that go along with the disease of alcoholism and not the presence of the liquid alcohol. And one of the things that I took out of that home I'll share with you after I'd gotten old enough to move out of the insanity that was that home, and I won't bore you with the stories because I could do that for the whole hour and we'd have a great time. We wouldn't get to any recovery. As I got a call one time in the middle of the night, and it was from my stepmom, and she said, your brother's been in a fight at the bar. That was nothing new. And she said that you need to go find him, which was nothing new. I just jumped up, found a phone booth, and changed into my suit with the red S on my chest and went out into the world. And I said, okay, I'll go get him. And I climbed out of bed and I got in my car and I went down. I found him in about 5 minutes at the local watering hole, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. In California, they have laws that close all of the bars at 2, so he was the only one in the parking lot outside of the bar there. He was sitting in his van, and he had picked up a shotgun at home, which is why she called me, and it was laying against the windowsill sticking out into the air where the glass used to be, because the glass had been smashed out of his van in the altercation he'd been in earlier. And I went and found him, and I did what I always did. I took the gun away, and I defused the situation. I put the gun in the trunk, and you know, he was there waiting for him to come back. I didn't want to tell him that the bars had closed. They weren't coming back till tomorrow. But he thought that made perfect sense, and I said about leaving. Well, on my way out of the parking lot, we all had CB radios in our cars, and he called me on the radio. He said, well, I'm going to go find him. I said, yeah, good, oh, fine. You have a nice night, and I'm headed home. Well, I didn't quite get out of the driveway when the radio piped up again and said, I found him there around the back. Oh, okay, so I turned the car around and headed back around, and this bar happened to be in a big shopping center, and around the back was a huge parking lot, acres of asphalt with some light standards in it, and really nobody there. And as I rounded the corner on this side, and he's rounding the corner on that side, there was, sure enough, there was about 3 or 4 cars in the middle of this parking lot, and he'd had an altercation with about 6 or 8 young Hispanic gentlemen, and he figured this was them, and he called me up on the radio again, and he said, I'm going in. Now, for those of you who do not speak Al-Anon, let me translate that for you. That translates to, we're going in. So he started in from his side and I started in my side, and we've got all 8 of them surrounded. And now I've got to come up with a plan. You see, there's 8 of them over there, and he's been at the bar drinking all night, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to deal with my 7. So the plan I came up with was, I decided what I would do is I'd take the car in there at a pretty good rate of speed. I'd been racing cars and motorcycles since I'd been a little kid, and I'd get that car going sideways, and if I slid in there sideways where a bunch of them were standing, I might be able to go side to side with one of those cars and pin maybe 4 of them and give me a chance to get out of the car, which was a critical moment in any gang fight, getting in or out of the car. Daddy taught me that. He also taught me to marry early and often. So I got in there and got a pretty good head of steam up, and I'm boring right down on these guys, and they're watching me. They haven't seen brother coming from the other side yet, and I got to the point of getting this car turned sideways and sliding it on in there when just about the point of no return, when the radio pipes up just one more time, and it says, I don't think that's them. I gathered that car up, and I went by those guys, still traveling a pretty good clip. I thought it would be ill-advised to stop and discuss my behavior with them on the way through, and kept on going, which is a great and wild and woolly story. I told that story in the presence of my friend Dick over here a couple of years ago, and he looked at me like I had 3 heads, and after a moment he said, why didn't you just drink? I didn't drink because drinking didn't do for me what it did for my brothers and for my current wife and a lot of other people in my life. I didn't like that feeling of being out of control. Drinking didn't work for me. I became the designated driver from the time I was a little kid, and the designated go-to guy to get him out of jail, get him out of gang fights and gunfights, and that's where I fit in my family and in my circle of friends, and that's what I did. That's a cute little story, except that I need to share with you that I wasn't a 17-year-old kid, you know, still in high school doing something that was irresponsible. I wasn't a fellow who didn't have any responsibilities in his life. I'd gotten out of that bed as a 22-year-old young man after being 4 years in the Marine Corps, where I'd gotten out as a sergeant during the Vietnam era. And I got out of that bed with a wife and two little kids in that house for whom I was the sole form of support. And it never occurred to me that if I ran in there that one of those guys would probably duck, I'd have killed him. And that I'd have gone to jail and that family would have lost their only means of support. And my priorities are upside down. I've come out of that family where blood is thicker than water, and we got the story about Boys Town, oddly enough, about, you know, carrying the boy, and he ain't heavy, he's my brother, and mixed in with, from my mom, he may be an axe murderer, but he's my son kind of mentality, that, you know, everything for the family and keep the family secret and stuff. And I don't know when my priorities got upside down, but it happened sometime growing up in that home with that, with all that behavior. I went out into the world and behaved, and that was nothing new. We did lots of that stuff. I met my first wife at a gang fight. As luck would have it, I was at my dad's house after having been in a gang fight the week before. My mother had sent me up there to get a lecture about getting into fights. What she failed to put together was that in the previous gang fight I was being lectured about, not only was my dad there, but he had driven us to the gang fight along with my then mother's husband, and to be in the fight, and I was going to get a lecture. And about that time the door swung open, and my brother and my two brothers were walking down the street with a couple of girls, and he'd gotten in a fight with them. His magic number was 8. There was 8 guys, and they'd gotten in a fight with 8 guys, and they were beating the crap out of him up the street. And the other brother came running in the middle of my lecture and said, "John's in a fight down the street, got to go get him." So me and my dad, our gang, both of us, that's the way it went. Went down the street, and I pulled in and pinned all 8 of them. I've looked at the logic of that in recent years, and it doesn't make nearly as much sense to me now as it did then, that I should trap 8 guys, and we would have them. We got them right where we want them. We had a heck of a fight, and my future ex-wife-to-be stood across the street and watched us do a crowbar and bumperjack melee. I've always thought it was unfair that my brother started that fight, and I had to marry her. Makes sense to you? It didn't make sense to me. I went off in the Marine Corps and had a couple of kids, and I'll share an incident with you and I'll move on about my mindset. And one of the biggest pieces of baggage I drug through the doors of Al-Anon has to do with my little girl. I had a little girl named Jessica. She was in 1978 at the age of 1 while I had come out of the Marine Corps, and right around the time I'd done that whole deal with the parking lot with my brother, there was an incident in which my little girl drowned in a little foot and a half deep kid pool in the backyard of our house in the care of a babysitter. And she lay in a coma for a year before her death, and we had brought her home to take care of her. And I'd like to tell you that I took care of that child, but I was not emotionally or even physically capable of taking care of that little girl, who required constant care around the clock. She required physical therapy and care of her trach tubes, and she was fed through a tube in her stomach, and all of the things that went on with that. And somehow or another, I'd learned this lesson as a kid, that your feelings are your enemy, that you can't ever let them out, and if they ever got out, my life would spin out of control. And I believed that with every fiber of my being, and I would regularly have panic attacks getting out of my bed. Between the time I could get out of that bed and get out of the house, I just couldn't. My heart sounded like a jet plane engine, and I couldn't stay there, and I had to go. What I'm describing to you is something that I've heard described from podiums in AA many times, and I have had I don't know if it's the dubious privilege of witnessing, is called a panic attack. I've seen it in my brothers. One of them in particular, when my father lay on his deathbed and my brother walked in, presumably to see possibly my father for the last time, and he's one of those brothers of mine whose drinking has bothered me over the years. And I watched that panic attack set in at his feet and roll up his body until it got to about his neck, and he had to flee the room where he would probably never see my dad again. And he was absolutely powerless before the onslaught of the fear that overcame him. Today I understand that, and I understand that that's what was happening to me. That when she passed away, having not benefited from my being able to take care of her and having put that entire load on that first wife, I put that piece of baggage back in the back of my head, and I carried it for what probably would have been for the rest of my life had I not found you folks. And went on about creating a lot of wreckage in my life. My father is one of those people who my biggest resentment in life was against my dad, because he was a womanizer. He had, at the time of his death, you know, I used to be terrified that he would die. And I wasn't terrified of losing him. I was terrified because I was the oldest responsible child. Notice I said responsible. That would probably have to do his eulogy. And I knew I'd get up there and tell you what a son of a bitch he was. And I was afraid that he would die because I'd have to get up there and tell you the truth about him. And I had tremendous resentments about him because of the way he treated my mother and all of his wives and girlfriends and stuff. When he passed away, I was executor of his estate, and we had to do a head count of his children because nobody knew. And there were 11 of us for sure and two possibles. My father was a very charming man. And I hated him. I hated him because of the way he treated all those people. And now I need to tell you that I went out into the world, particularly after the incident with my daughter, and I behaved exactly the same as my father. It's stuff that I'm not proud of today. It's stuff that I had to deal with in a rigorous inventory and an amends step. It's stuff that one day at a time I do not participate in today because I didn't like the way I lived back then, and I really like the way I live today, so I don't do that. But one of the things that I did was I went out into the world and I dated just like I was single. And I spent as much time away from the home as I could, particularly when my daughter was still alive. I work in the movie business and I just stayed gone all the time. It was convenient. It was easy in our business. We'd work regularly 16, 18, 20-hour days. It was no big deal. And they might get rid of me, you know, after 12 hours. They say, you know, because I'm a specialist, they say, oh, we don't need you anymore. You can go home. And I'd say, okay, and I'd stay till everybody clocked out because I couldn't go home. And I went out in the world and I created a lot of wreckage. And I was on a location in Arizona working on a picture. And I was to meet the lady who was to change my life. And I met her on my way to from the coffee pot one morning. See, I'm a morning person. I'm the best I'm going to be all day, right out of bed first thing in the morning. I'm cute, I'm clever, and I'm witty, and I'm bright and shiny. And I'm a tremendous irritation to any alcoholics in the vicinity. They don't appreciate that near as much as you folks do. And I was my usual sunny self coming from the coffee pot, and my beautiful wife Leslie was coming the other way, and I said something cheery like, good morning, and she growled at me. I filed it away. A couple of days later, we were playing Frisbee. We were very busy in the movie business, big, lot of job responsibility, a lot of things to do. We were throwing this big old heavy Frisbee around, and my friend Clarence flung this Frisbee at me, and it went over my head. Clarence was 7 feet tall. He must have thought I was 7 feet tall because I missed it by about 2 feet, and I was heading for this van, and there was a van load of extras getting ready to work on this movie, getting out with big hair and tight jeans and looking pretty good, you know. We like to keep them around for crew morale. And I hollered, look out, which is the only direction my wife has ever taken from me in 15 years that I've known her. She looked out, and that Frisbee hit her right between the eyes and knocked her out cold. I ran over there. Anybody see a theme in this? I ran over and picked her up, and I started apologizing for a Frisbee I didn't throw. And I apologized up and down, offered to get her the medic, get her an ice bag. I mean, it hit her right between the eyes and stuff, and I was irritating her. It was morning. I was just irritating her, and finally I said, is there anything I can do? And she said, you could buy me a drink sometime. Hello? Glad to be here. You know, my friend Clarence hit her in the head with the Frisbee, and I had to marry her. Do you think that's fair? I was thinking about that yesterday. Anyway, I was dating on that location like I did a lot of locations, and I happened to be dating her best friend, which she found me particularly attractive because she knew I was married and I was dating her best friend, and she decided that we needed to meet, and she put the moves on me one night, and I was out with her girlfriend at a bar, and she took me on the dance floor and tried to seduce me. I said, I'm with somebody. She says, I know, I really like that. I like a girl who shows initiative. So I tracked down her unlisted phone number, and I called her up. She thought that much work merited a date, and we went out. We saw each other a little bit, and I left location, went to another one, and she came to visit me, and then my wife came to visit, and she was flying in as the other one was flying out. Why make two trips to the airport, I ask you? So they crossed in the air there. My wife, Leslie, thought that was all very exciting. I was just making a mess of my life and a lot of other people's lives. Eventually, we finished that movie and went back to California, and Leslie, if she ever gets to tell you her story, she was a six-month wonder. She would go someplace and just do great for 3 months, get fired for the last three, and then move. And she was in a series of geographics from Omaha, Nebraska, headed west until she ran out of ground, which happened to be in Los Angeles where I lived, and she had just finished up 6 months in Page, Arizona when I'd met her and decided California would be good, and she moved on out there. She called me up, and we saw each other a couple of times. Our first real date in California, I went to go pick her up, and got lost. She'd given me directions while she was drunk. I couldn't find her. So I'm calling her up saying, what? You said I'm going straight. It's a T intersection. There is no straight. And she's trying to tell me where to go. And she doesn't know where she is. She's from out of town. She's drunk and she's lost. So I cross back over the freeway about 10 minutes later and come across this horrific car accident. And there's this little Honda car buried in the grill of this Oldsmobile. And the Honda has obviously lost the encounter. The person in it is this beautiful blonde lady. I'll explain that in a minute. Who's not breathing. and there's police and ambulances and fire trucks, and they've got hydraulic jaws out there peeling the car open to get her out. And I hear the officers saying, we don't know who she is. She doesn't have any ID. She's got out-of-state plates on her little Honda car. That was the only part that was straight enough to read, was the back license plate. And I said, well, I know who she is, and I gave them her name, and we all went off to the hospital. And in the hospital there, I was sitting with her while they're waiting, and that was my beautiful wife, Leslie, by the way. In the hospital there, I was sitting with her on the table waiting for them to come and treat her broken bones and her trauma. She had a crushed neck pipe and had suffered pretty bad trauma to her chest area from a hit in the steering wheel and stuff, and she quit breathing. And I ran out in the hallway, and I called a nurse, and they come running in with the crash carts, and they jumped around on her for a couple of minutes and got her going again. And when she came out again, she rolled her head over towards me on a gurney and looked straight at me with these great big eyes, looked right at me, and she said, let me go. She said, let me go. Which I dismissed, because I know everything, as delirium. You know, maybe they've given her some drugs, or maybe it's the wreck or whatever. She was completely delirious. The reason I tell you about that today is because I understand that what little I know about the disease of alcoholism, because I am not an alcoholic, and my wife's first AA sponsor assured me that that was the case and that I would never know what an alcoholic knows, is I got a momentary glimpse into the other side of what it must be like to live in the active disease of alcoholism. And years later, when I came to you folks and I heard sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous and members of the Al-Anon family group share from podiums like this about the disease of alcoholism, I began to understand the significance of what I had seen that day. What I had seen was somebody whose life was so miserable behind the active disease that they would rather have died than paid the price for one more car wreck, for one more debacle, for having one more person. She knew the police were out there going to take her away after this was over. She'd been drunk, and she'd hit this woman on her own side of the street. She'd run through a red light to do it. And she would rather die than pay that price. The hospital determined she didn't have any insurance. It was a little hospital with a little emergency ward, and they just didn't have the financial resources to take in strays, unlike me. And they threw her out. They didn't treat any of her broken bones. They put a neck brace on her, loaded her in a chair, and took her out to my car. They loaded her in the car, and she can't talk. She can't hardly move. And the nurse says, I hope you're near a hospital, because she's not doing real well. I said, thanks for sharing. So now we're in the car, and we're debating where to take her. You see, I haven't yet found the place where she's living, which is some phantom uncle whose existence we debate to this day. I have not seen him. She has an imaginary friend here somewhere, too. Is Connie in the room? I figure she made her up, too. We have a running banter for 15 years about her friend Connie that I have yet to meet. And she can't find the uncle's house anymore either, so we don't know what to do with her. She whispers to me, I guess you can take me to a hotel. I thought about that for 8 seconds. I know today that what I figured then was probably the right thing. I knew if I took her to a hotel, I'd have been checking the paper every day to see when they found this dead blonde in a hotel room, because she'd expired, abandoned in a hotel room. And I said, no, I got a better idea. I'll just take you home. Did y'all want to think about that a little while? Because did you forget I got a wife at home and a family? And I did. I called on the phone. I told my first wife, I have a friend's been in a wreck. I'm bringing her home. And if you came in late, this is an Al-Anon meeting, just so you don't. This is not a drunkalog. It's the other side of the drunkalog. And my first wife met us in the driveway, and we carried her in the door. And my wife has shared from many podiums in AA that I dropped her coming through the door into my house. With all of her injuries, I dropped her on the floor. And I might have been a little nervous. She describes that time. She lived with us for about 6 months. We laid her on the bed there and waited for her to die for about 3 days. I really didn't think she was going to make it. She pulled through, and we managed to get her to a doctor and get her some medical care and get some of her broken bones set, and get her some painkillers. She needed them painkillers. It turns out, we found out later, she needed them real bad because she couldn't drink during that time. Painkillers was all she had. She describes that 6 months or so that we all lived together as some of the happiest days of her life up until then. She had a new mommy and a new daddy. That'd be me. New brother, new sister, new dogs. Life was good. I made a wheelchair out of a kitchen chair and put wheels on it so I could fit her through the doorways. And we wheeled her around the house. And we showered together and went to the bathroom together. I'd hold her up and wash her. And I'd spin her around. My wife would wash the other side. We put her. It's very romantic. It didn't get deeply complicated until she got well enough to start getting around. And my first wife began setting her up on double dates. with us, and we'd go out to dinner, and I'd be sitting next to my wife, and my girlfriend with her date would be rubbing my leg under the table, and I became really confused. So when she said she was starting to get some job interviews and she wanted to go off to Texas to take a job, I thought that was a great idea, and I sent her off to Texas, and I didn't think I'd ever see her again. And I finally set about doing something that I hadn't had the courage to do prior to that time. I initiated some divorce proceedings and separated from that wife. And Leslie and I kept in touch, and she was down there. Guess how long she was in Texas? Anybody guess? Very good. 6 months went by, and she called up and said, I want to come back to California. So I jumped in my truck with one of my other brothers, one of my foster brothers, and we drove straight through to Houston, Texas, and packed her lock, stock, barrel, and cat into the trailer I had and drove straight home to live happily ever after. Yeehaw! I got to spend the last year and a half of my wife's drinking with her, and I got an education about the disease of alcoholism that I hope I never forget. And a lot of stuff went on during that year. I wasn't sure what was going on. Oddly enough, when we checked into the hotel last night, there was a movie on TV that happened to be a movie I was working on when she'd been with me for just about a year. And we were up in Washington or Oregon someplace, and at the wrap party for that location, she misbehaved as she often did behind her alcoholism. By the way, she was a blackout drinker. I thought she just was a lightweight. She'd have a couple glasses of wine and fall asleep, and I'd carry her to bed. And it was wonderful. And she'd wake up every morning and crawl over to my side and get a good look at my mug to see who I was and go, because she really had no idea. And then she had to wait until I got up and around to see how I was behaving to determine how she had behaved the night before. If I was happy and joyous and free, she thought she'd done okay. If I was mad, she'd go, oh, well, he'll get over it. It was a running theme in our relationship. But at that rap party, she staggered over to the director's table, a nationally renowned, a world-renowned director, and leaned over him to explain to him a few finer points about directing movies that she thought he should have, and spilled his wine in his lap. And I thought that'd be a bad career move for me, so I whisked her out of there and took her back to our room, and I grounded her. I confined her to her room. We had a daddy-daughter thing going on. Anybody catching that? On the way home from that trip, she confided to me for the first time that she believed that she had a problem with alcoholism. And I had an interesting answer for that. I said, no, you don't. I said, no, you don't. I said, you just have a couple of glasses of wine a day. Just stop. Because I never saw her drink more than that. She'd be drunker than $50 when I got home, and she'd have to maintain until I was there for a little while and watched her consume a glass or two of wine, and then she could loosen up and be drunk and pass out. I just thought she was a cheap drunk. When I asked her how come I never knew she was drunk all the time, she says, that's why, because you never saw me sober. You had nothing to compare it to. During that year, we fought like cats and dogs. After she told me she had a problem with alcohol, I began helping her get sober. I was checking her breath. She was working at the restaurant at night where, thank God, they let her drink for free, or we'd still be doing financial amends 15 years later. They were more than happy to have her drink and hang around there and do the books and stuff. I haven't figured that out yet. She finally, a series of circumstances happened, and it was just getting uglier and uglier in our home. And she was evil, mean, and nasty all the time. I finally came home from another location. I was done. I was going to throw her out, and she knew that. And prior to my getting home, she decided she needed to get some help. And she laid in bed and she drank, trying to drink herself to death. She drank until she passed out, and she'd wake up alive again. She tried again. For 3 days she did that. She couldn't wake up. She couldn't kill herself with alcohol, is what she was trying to do. So she called a recovery center and checked herself in. And I got home about a week early, because she was planning to be 2 weeks sober when I got home and be wonderful, and it would all be better. And she still had the shakes. And I asked her for a glass of wine, and she dropped it 3 times and ran out of the house hysterical crying, because I would have a glass of wine and I'd drink half of it and maybe leave some. It was just a little goblet about this big. And she run out crying, and it was nothing new. She behaved like that all the time. I didn't really take any particular notice of it. And she came back in and she said, I had to get some help for my alcoholism. She believed that if she had gone and gotten help after she told me the first time, and I said, you don't have a problem, that I'd have thrown her out for getting help. I didn't say that, but that's what she heard, and I think she still believes that today. Maybe it was true. I don't know. So she's in this recovery place, and an AA started. A couple things happened with AA. An AAH&I panel came in there with a little guy whose eyes glowed with that glowing sobriety thing, that light that you get that comes on back in your eyes after you get sober for a little while and you start carrying the message to other people. And she started to get a little bit of hope. And another panel came in, which was really to change both of our lives. It was two men and a woman. It was raining and nasty outside, and all three of those people, my wife pretty much to this day, will tell you that they didn't want to go on that panel that night. They didn't want to be there. They had better things to do, and they went anyway. And one of those women who didn't want to be there that night, who went because she was being of service in AA, gave my wife her card, was to become her first sponsor. A woman who I dearly loved. I call her AA's answer to Lizzie Borden. If you guys were all chatting amongst yourself before the meeting, when she walked through the back door back there, you'd all stop. She's a very stoic, really sober woman. We'd walk into the room very serious. And you would all stop and look. And she scared the hell out of everybody. She didn't scare me. I liked her right out of the box. Because she was mean to Leslie. She gave Leslie her card, and Leslie started calling her. She didn't have any other options. She'd call her up and Pat would hang up on her and stuff. She'd get in a conversation, and Leslie would say, "Well, I know such and such," and Pat would hang up on her. She'd call her back and say, "Why'd you hang up?" She said, "You said you know. We got nothing else to talk about." She didn't know she could hang up on Pat. Pat told her, she says, "You know, for a year her check-in with Pat was every day she called Pat's machine. She'd get the machine and say, 'Hi, this is Leslie, just checking in. Didn't have a drink today. Think it's going to be all right. If I just get rid of that son of a bitch, I'll call you tomorrow.'" She couldn't share that with me until I'd been in Al-Anon a little while. And their sponsor said, "We don't make any major decisions in AA in our first year. You are extra sick. It's 3 years. Wouldn't let her leave. Leslie decided if Pat met me, I was out there, folks. You already heard some of it. That's just the tip of the iceberg. She thought if Pat met me, she'd give her permission to get rid of me. So she invited over for dinner. She's coming up on a year sober, and it's Saturday night at the fights. Everything's the same as when she drank, except now she never sleeps. I'm not getting a break from it any time. At least she had the decency to be passed out and slobbering on herself when she drank. She's sober. She's awake all the time. And we're not doing well. So Pat comes over for dinner. We have this nice dinner. She asked my opinion about a few things, which I was known to give freely. And they got all down and went in the kitchen, and they're doing the dishes and stuff, and she leaned over and she says, "What do you think?" Pat says, "I don't like him either. But you made him your God. You live with him." And wouldn't let her leave. About a year later, she invited Pat over for dinner again after Leslie had been sober for a while, and I think I'd started going to Al-Anon. During dinner, Pat looked over at me and said, "I don't think you should have to live like this. I believe you should throw her out." I loved Pat. Leslie quit inviting her to dinner. That woman saved the life of the woman who I've come to love with every fiber of my being and who I admire as probably the finest member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I will ever know, based on the fact that, and I know a lot of people in AA, and I hear a lot of people talk about their recovery in AA and around AA, is that every night I go home with her and I watch her walk the walk that she talks from a podium and take those 12-step calls from central office and go out in the middle of the night and pick those girls up and do the things that she does that she talks about from a podium. I watch her live that every day, and someday I hope to grow up to be just like her. And that's not the person I described to you during her drinking. I didn't think I would ever learn anything from her, and I have the greatest admiration for Alcoholics Anonymous and for people who walk the line of sobriety in AA. I love to watch 12-step work in action. I'm not capable of helping an alcoholic, but I love watching other people do it. You know, we'll be at a meeting and a newcomer will stick their hand up, and I watch my wife and her girlfriends go to work, and I stand in awe of that. I've always stood in awe of that until about 6 months ago. I was flying to Syracuse, New York to go to a conference, and I was just buckling into a plane I was about to take off in, and I saw Clancy coming out of the cockpit. I was really hoping it was a social call, not a 12-step call he was making up there. It's the first doubt I've ever had about watching 12-step work in AA. Shared that with him yesterday. So now her and Lizzie Borden are trying to 12-step me into Al-Anon. I'm not having any of it. I'm telling them it's her problem. I don't have a problem. Leave me alone. And Leslie tricked me. She said, "You know, the people in AA think that you're my imaginary friend." You know, that hits a special nerve with me because we've talked about that. "And you need to go to at least one meeting a week with me so that they know that you're for real." And I said, "Okay." So they'd say in every meeting, "Are there any alcoholics present?" They'd all stick their hand up. I really wanted to ask, "Does anybody bring an alcoholic as the price of admission?" I could go like that. She's right here. For about 6 months, I'm going to AA, and I'm beginning to hear the music of recovery from sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody in that room seemed to know anything about Al-Anon. I began asking some questions discreetly, not to give any satisfaction to her and Lizzie Borden, about Al-Anon, and nobody really seemed to know, but there was terrific recovery in that room, and I learned an awful lot. Eventually, I was to find my way into a meeting. I called our central office in Los Angeles, and I asked them to send me a directory, and I snuck out to the mailbox to check it before anybody could get it every day so they wouldn't know. And I snuck out to my first Al-Anon meeting, which I went to a meeting. It was a newcomer meeting. It was in a hospital recovery unit. I've not been back since then. I wasn't particularly impressed with what I saw there. Most of the people at the meeting were brand new, had relatives on the ward, and they were there as a compulsory part of the treatment. They had to go to this Al-Anon meeting. There were a couple of folks, long-timers, had about a year. They seemed to do all the talking, and we had to do all the listening, and I just didn't catch fire that day. 2 days later, I went to another meeting, thank God. I guess I'd been listening. They said to come back to another meeting. And I walked into a meeting with a bunch of little old people that very much resembled the folks. When Leslie had been on the recovery unit in that place trying to get sober, they brought us in for a family day. And I really think that they had me there to give me the pitch for getting some help for myself. I don't remember if they mentioned Al-Anon, but I wound up arguing with the counselor. I didn't see anything in common between me and the other wives. You know, it's just us wives there. I was the only guy. But when I went to that meeting 2 days after my first meeting, in a room full of people that looked just like the folks that I'd seen in that recovery unit, the wives of the gentlemen that were on the ward over there, for some reason, something had happened in me. I guess it was time I began to hear some similarities instead of some differences, and I realized that I was in the right place and I needed to keep coming. That was a little over 11 years ago, and by the end of that first week, I was a regular attendee at least 4 Al-Anon meetings, and it's vacillated since then between 4 and 5 meetings. Is something like, I don't know, well over 3,000 meetings I've been to in 11 years. And every week I had an obligation and still have one to attend a regular open AA meeting with my wife. We go as a couple. I don't go to any of her other meetings, and she doesn't go to any of mine. But it's the only way that I can ever learn about the disease of alcoholism, which I do not have. Some of the best lessons I've learned about applications of the steps and recovery and my disease as well as the disease of alcoholism, I've learned in AA meetings from sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have the deepest regard and respect for those folks. I really do. I'm impressed by anybody who can go a single day without drinking, because I understand the symptoms of the disease, and I'm watching it progressively kill my family, successfully kill my family for generations, and continues to do that to this day. To date, my wife and I are the only members of any kind of 12-step program. One cousin I've seen come in once. I'm not sure where she is now, and I've got an older half-brother that I saw for a while sober, and I've not seen him in a long time, so I don't know where he is. By that weekend, I had acquired a home group. It was a Saturday morning meeting. I could ride my bike to it. And, you know, I'm the only guy showing up at these meetings. There's a couple of guys here and there. They're not real regular. One older fellow I didn't identify with too much had about 25 years at that time, and I'm really trying to fade into the woodworks. I'm the only guy at a room full of women. I'm trying to be anonymous, you know. So I decide the answer to that is to go to the Saturday morning meeting and ride my bicycle, because I like to ride bikes and I can do a 40 or 50 mile ride and take in a meeting. And I'm showing up in heat shrieks, spandex, glow-in-the-dark, road cone colored bicycle suit to be anonymous at a room full of women. I wasn't all here. I'm still not all there. I'm showing up early with a knapsack full of sweats. I'm changing before the meeting every day, and I'm in street clothes when you get there, and I'm the first one there, and I'm setting up the chairs, and when everybody would leave, I'd be the last one out closing the door and sweeping the floors, and I'd, you know, change back into my roadie suit and go ride my bicycle. And today I'm still one of the first ones that goes to most of my meetings, and I still set up the chairs at most of those meetings. And I do it for a different reason today, is because I'm the only one that knows how to do it right. I'm guessing I'm not the only one in here that's the only one that knows how to do it right. I sponsored this sick bunch of guys who caught on to that early on, and now they beat me to the meetings and set the chairs up wrong to watch me fix them. They've gotten much better with my tutelage, and now they set them up absolutely perfectly, and they put one backwards for me to fix when I come there, and I'm okay. So I'm going to this meeting, and I'm looking around, and I'm not seeing. There was a guy there. I asked him to sponsor me for about 3 months. He didn't have much time. He had about 6 months in the program when I came in, and he'd never worked the steps. And, you know, I'm not getting any answers. It's okay for an hour and a half in the meetings, but I'm still going home cutting people off on the freeway. Anybody ever drive to a meeting? I don't know if you do this in Iowa. I'm driving to a meeting, and somebody will be uncourteous to me on the freeway. And I will be uncourteous in return. And we'll both do this before we exchange the customary greetings out the window. And pretty soon we're cutting each other off and racing, and I've gone past my exit making sure that they get my point, you know, or something like that. And then as I'm getting off to go to the meeting, they get off either in front or behind me. And now I'm watching them. And I follow them. And they go right by the meeting, because if they turn in, I'm going straight. For an hour and a half, I'm okay, but if that jackass turns into the meeting, I can't go there because I've just done all this stuff on the freeway and I'll be embarrassed. I'm coming to meetings and I'm just crazy as a hootie owl. So finally, I heard a lady talk about sponsorship, and she said some things that has just really held me in good stead, and I'll share them with you today. And it had to do with the fact that she had changed sponsors several times. I didn't know you could do that. I thought, I'm stuck with this guy who doesn't know anything, and I figured by that time I'm figuring out that he's there to meet girls. And I'd love to be there to meet girls. That's really kind of, when I came in the door, she's not minding at home in his room full of pretty women. I'm thinking, well, things don't work out at home. I've already established my behavior. And she talked about changing sponsors, and she shared this, and I've shared this with a lot of people since then, and it's just wonderful. She said, as a sponsor, I've been fired as a sponsor. She said, when my ego is not involved, because my ego should not be involved, it's not my business who I sponsor, who or how many or how long they stay. And she said, when they fire me as a sponsor and move on, I take it as a compliment that they've grown enough with me as a sponsor, they recognize some area of their life that they need to move on and get some help in from somebody else, and I take that as a compliment. And to this day, I haven't stalked anybody who's ever fired me as a sponsor, and I haven't found it necessary. For the most part, they don't go out of my life. They still call me. I just don't have any authority over them anymore. And that night, I cornered a woman at the meeting who had what I wanted. She had a terrific recovery and a terrific spiritual basis to her recovery. I had none of that. You see, when my daughter died, the last vestiges of any God I thought might exist in the universe went in the ground with her, and I threw dirt on both of them. And I had, excuse me, I had no intentions of coming to you and finding a God of my understanding. I just wanted to know how to make her behave. Give me the secret handshake and I'll be fine. And this lady agreed to be my sponsor. It created some controversy in my home because my wife is old school AA that says men sponsor men and women sponsor women. And she was very threatened by that. And for a while we had to butt out of each other's program, which in retrospect was probably the smartest thing we've done in recovery, was to get out of each other's way. I quit asking her about hers. And she had to quit asking me about mine because I had to quit answering. Did you talk to your sponsor? Did you share with her? Did you do a sexual inventory? And she was later to make amends to both myself and that sponsor because she said that lady sponsored me for 5 years. And she always considered herself a temporary sponsor for all 5 years. And we did a journey through the steps, which I really believe saved my life, at least saved the quality of my life. Leslie was to make an amends to both of us. She said, you've grown an awful lot with this woman as a sponsor. And it was none of my business, and I apologize for having butted in. Today we share our recovery with each other. We're not on the same path. Neither one of us is ahead of the other one. We're not in a race. If she comes to me with an issue related to her sobriety, I'm more than happy to hand her off to her sponsor and her AA girlfriends because it's none of my business, and I tell her that because her asking my opinion about her recovery is as fair as me asking her to watch my drink while I go to the bathroom. So we don't go there. This lady sponsored me. She was addicted to service. Every job that ever came up, her hand went in the air, and I got the job. You know, that's been probably one of the best things that's ever happened to me. I went places. I was in the skit. Now, I'm in a room full of women trying to fade into the woodwork. I'm finally gotten good enough that I can show up in my bicycle suit without my roadie, without my street clothes. And actually, the first time I did that, I showed up, I left the things at home. It occurred to me that that was my meeting and that was my chair, and I, by God, earned it. I showed up in my bicycle suit, and this redheaded woman, I hadn't stuck my hand up as a newcomer, and I didn't get a lot of keep coming back. I was really trying to keep to myself, and she came up and patted me on my spandex butt and said, keep coming back, honey. And I did. So I'm in this skit. One of the ladies in the room writes a skit, The Garden of Life. We're going to do it at an alathon or something, and they need an alcoholic weed to seduce Mix Daisy. Guess who that was? I'm the token guy and the token alcoholic. I've already got this resentment because we'll go to conventions together. My wife's dragging me through these conventions, and we're going down through the hall. I'm seeing people coming the other way looking at us, and I can tell by their eyes what they're thinking. My, what that poor woman must have went through when that guy was drinking. Fortunately, they did something else which gave me a resentment. They gave us road cone orange badges as Al-Anons. You know, nice pastel colors for the alcoholics, but road cone orange and caution yellow for us so that no alcoholics would accidentally start a conversation with one of us and not know how to get out. I had a resentment about that for a while, too. So I did that thing, and as she's got me into service, I wound up going to intergroup and doing things and began to learn about service and the traditions and all that stuff. And I've done a lot of service in Al-Anon. They put me into jobs long before I know what's going on, so I won't screw it up. I was 5 years in Al-Anon. They elected me as the chairman of the Los Angeles area intergroup, and they're asking me questions I'm supposed to know the answers to. I don't know nothing. I started going to groups to study the traditions and the concepts to learn how to live in service, because I like make nice. You know, I'm fine during the meeting, but at the business meeting afterwards, when you argue very strongly both sides of an opinion about how the chairs ought to be set up, I'm not comfortable. Where I come from, I get an adrenaline rush. I'm looking for a piece of furniture to hit the closest person to me so I can get out of there with my skin. I have a bad reaction to that. I went to an AA meeting with my wife to her home group when she was pretty new, and a guy went off on everybody in the group and told them all to go take a flying jump, and not in as nice a language as that, and threatened anybody told him to keep coming back, he was going to beat the hell out of him. And at the end of the meeting, somebody said, keep coming back. Now, I'm having a reaction to this guy. The adrenaline's up. I've got a chair selected. I'm thinking maybe I can hit him in the throat and close his windpipe because he's between me and the door. I'm figuring my way out of there. And I'm looking around the room full of alcoholics, and nobody's having the reaction to him that I'm having. I'm the only one having an adrenaline rush, the only one plotting my escape. Afterwards, I said to my wife, is that guy new? She goes, nah, he's been around about 8 years, been doing that ever since he got here. I'm glad I'm an Al-Anon. We very seldom have, you know, seizures, and we only have to carry a wooden spoon at our meetings and stuff. I've seen that, but we don't do it too much at Al-Anon. Anyway, a lot of water has gone under the bridge since then. It's been my privilege to be of service in a lot more areas than the ones I've shared with you, and to stand at a podium or two, and a lot's happened in our life. And you know, before my wife got sober and I got into Al-Anon, our world was getting smaller and smaller because all the people that we hung out with, we just began to peel off, you know. Folks that I was too embarrassed to take my wife around because of her behavior, we just wouldn't go there anymore. And folks that didn't want to be around me because they didn't like me when I was around her, and frankly, looking back, I didn't like me when I was around her, peeled off from this side. And pretty soon we're down to just us and four walls. By the time she got sober, it was us and a dog or two. And what's happened in recovery in Al-Anon and AA is our world continues to get bigger. I've come here and there's people that I knew would be here, and it's been great to see them, and I've run into other folks that I didn't know were going to be here, and had breakfast with one of them this morning. Everywhere that I go, pretty much, I run into people that I know because of service in Al-Anon, because of doing things with people in recovery who I just love going. We go on vacations usually every year. We missed this year, but we'll probably go again next year. With all people in recovery, we invade some foreign country, and they never know what to think about when we get what's going to happen when we get there, and we just have a blast. And they're sad to see us go because they have a blast when we're there. I love people in recovery. And our world gets bigger and bigger. The downside of that is that as your world gets bigger, there's this growing number of people who you care tremendously about. I'm here because I love an alcoholic. I'm here because I love a lot of alcoholics. Not all of them are sober. I love a lot of alcoholics today who aren't sober and can't get sober and may never get sober. I love them. I have boundaries that I have to set for my own personal and emotional safety, but it doesn't mean I don't love them. And I'm related to a lot of them. And some of them I've just seen, you know, in and out of the doors of AA, that perennial newcomer who... I heard a speaker when I was new stand at a microphone say something I never forgot. He had some time in AA, and he said, there's some people in the room that every week were a newcomer. Every week. Hand go up. Every week. And he stood at the point, I'm judging them. Why can't they get sober? They're here. They got the answer. You know, I've got my judge gown and gavel on. He said, I want to ask you a question. Do any of you know who wants to be sober in this room more than anybody else? He says, I'll tell you who it is. He says, those guys that stuck their hand up again as a newcomer want it more than any of you, and don't you forget it. And I have not forgotten. Wanting it isn't a prerequisite for getting sober, as I understand it. I've seen people that want it die of the disease of alcoholism. I've seen people come to AA with a nudge from the judge and a wife and an employer with a huge resentment, not want to be there, get sober, and never have another drink to this day that I know of. I don't know what the magic answer is. I know that I have been tremendously blessed to have a sober household, that my wife walks a terrific AA program, and I'm blessed to be able to watch that, and the people that she hangs with do too. As a result of that world getting bigger, we've lost a lot of folks in the last couple of years. I've been wearing a suit out at funerals. We've lost some giants in AA, and I've lost some close family members. And one of them is a lady I'll share with you who was my wife's daily sobriety check. And she called our house every day at 7 o'clock in the morning, every single day. The day didn't start for our household until Vanda called in to check in. She'd gotten sober just before my wife, and they were sisters in sobriety, and she called every day. And last year, Vanda died of cancer. And I was really worried about my wife and her sobriety, because this is a big part of her routine every day, and she's on the phone every day. I don't do the phone very well, but my wife, if anything ever happens to her, I'm putting a phone on her headstone, because it isn't going to stop ringing just because she's not here. I was really worried about my wife, and I was worried about Vanda. And one night she got a call. Vanda had throat cancer, and she went over to go get her in the middle of the night because she couldn't breathe. And she was really trying to take care of herself, and she really didn't want to go to a hospital or anything else. And my wife called up and says, Vanda's not doing very well. I'm going to bring her home. And I said, okay. Brought Vanda home. Vanda spent the last 8 or 9 days of her life in our house. And our house filled up full of people in Al-Anon and AA. And we took care of Vanda. And it filled up full of love. And it filled up. There was a young lady there who's my wife's cousin from Chillicothe, Missouri, who'd never been around anybody in recovery, who happened to be visiting. And she got to help us with Vanda. And she got to see people in recovery. And I started dragging her to Alateen meetings. And then I sent her to SCAC. God, she... Southern California Alateen Conference is a big conference for the Alateens in Southern Cal. I sent her there kicking and screaming. She didn't want to go. And she flew back from Missouri this year to go to SCAC because she cried for 3 days after she'd come home because she was going to miss all those people that she'd met in a place she didn't want to go. And I get it. The reason I tell you that is because that baggage that I carried that I had pretty much dealt with in my trip through the steps having to do with my inability to be a man in the face of my daughter's illness and my inability to be there, that when Vanda lay in our living room, I helped with Vanda, and I was perfectly comfortable, and I felt nothing but love. I didn't feel that fear coming in through my feet, and I helped with her care and her bathing and her feeding and her medications and all the stuff that you do. And I realized when she had passed that she'd given me a gift of helping me complete a ninth step, that I didn't think that was what it was about, and I did. The last thing I'll share with you is something that's changed in my life recently. You know, I always think that I get asked to speak somewhere, it'd be nice to just have a story and tell a story and get down and have the same story be just fine by me, and God keeps having other plans. 2 years ago, we were speaking at a conference in South Bay in Southern California, and I was supposed to speak on Monday morning, and it's probably one of the finest conventions I've ever been to anywhere. It's the South Bay Roundup, and it's wonderful cooperation between Al-Anon and AA. And I see that cooperation when I come out here to Nebraska and conferences out in this area. I do, and I admire it greatly. And on Sunday morning on the 4th of July, I found my beautiful wife dead on the bathroom floor in a pool of her own blood after having a grand mal seizure, 11 years into sobriety. Alcoholism is a progressive, fatal disease. It's so fatal it kills people that don't even have it. We lost a guy at one of my Al-Anon meetings who was calling me up. He hadn't asked me to sponsor him, but he was calling me. He stuck a gun in his mouth a week before Christmas, and he died of the disease of alcoholism because the phone weighed too much to pick up on the day that he needed help. It's a progressive, fatal disease, and it kills people long into sobriety. One of my wife's earliest and longest sponsees took her life about 3 years ago, 2 years ago. I called my sponsor. I was crushed because our sponsees are like our kids. We kind of go everywhere together. I drag mine on service commitments, and she drags hers to retreat weekends and stuff, and we're this whole family unit. And she took her life, and I called my sponsor, who, thank God, was also sober in AA. I've had to change sponsors because he moved to Boise, Idaho. And I told him what happened. I was angry about it, and he said, alcoholism got another one. She was sober 7 years. How did alcoholism get another one? And he said that alcoholism is so powerful that it can reach past the plug in the jug and kill them anyway. And alcoholism took another one. And I began to understand a little bit about that, what it was like. My wife has sponsored another woman who's been in and out of AA for 5 years. We love her like a child, drunk or sober. She's gotten progressively worse and has finally got homeless. She is a 30-year-old woman with 4 little children. And powerless before the onslaught of the disease of alcoholism. And my wife asked me if I'd take her to a recovery house, to a halfway house, and because she was flying out of town. She sent me on an AA 12-step call to take a drunk woman to a recovery house. And I thought that would be a bad idea, so I asked her to send one of her sponsees with me. And we went over and banged on the door. Nobody answered. We banged on it again, and we were just getting ready to... We're drawing straws. We're Batman and Robin in AA, her and I. One of us is going to climb over the balcony and kick down the plate glass doors and drag her to recovery, you know. And she finally opens the door, and she's drunk, naked, and wet. And then she had plans other than going to the halfway house we were going to take her to. And my friend Kip said, "That's why I'm here." She took her in and dressed her, and we packed her and took her in. And we farmed her kids out all over town because these are children that had been heavily affected by the disease of alcoholism. And hopefully their mom's going to this place to get sober. It turned out it wasn't her last drink, and we don't know if she's had it yet. After about 2 weeks, we wound up with the two middle kids, and they've been with us for 4 months. You see, for a lot of years after the loss of my daughter, I couldn't be around little kids at all. I especially couldn't be around little dark-haired, dark-eyed, beautiful little girls like my daughter, who was two when she passed away. I had done an inventory, and I'd done an amends to the best of my ability. I'd done a graveside with my daughter, a place I hadn't gone for years after she died, and I really thought that business was done, but it wasn't. And these two beautiful little girls have come into our house and changed our life. And we don't know if we're going to have them for another week or for 15 years. We don't know. We don't know if Mom's going to get sober and live happily ever after or die of this dreadful disease. We don't know that. So we take care of these little girls one day at a time. But you see, I have this loving higher power who knew that there was a place in my heart that needed to be healed that couldn't have been reached any other way. And He chose to put these little girls in my life. I had no plans. I already miss going to movies where they don't wear clothes and they talk dirty. We go see Shrek and Spy Kids, and they're 4 and 6 years old, and they just charm my heart. And we got one of them's going to be in Al-Anon, and one's in AA. One beer and she's gone. We know that. We've got them all figured out and divided up, we're taking steps to ensure the safety of these children because their mom's out there. She did a suicide attempt 2 weeks ago. She has 29 staples in her arm. And we got her into another halfway house, and she broke out after 3 weeks. And I heard I would judge her. Here's a mom who's not taking care of business. She's been to AA. She knows where the answers are. I could judge her harshly. But I heard a speaker say not too long ago, somebody said, why do they drink? And he said, because they don't know they don't have to. She doesn't know that she doesn't have to drink. She hasn't figured that out yet, 5 years in, out of the door. I'm not going to do any more 12-step work in AA. It's a little agreement that we have, unless I can help it. And I'm going to keep coming back to Al-Anon because this is where I get my experience, strength, and hope. I'm going to keep that lady in my prayers, and I hope to God she gets sober and gets those kids back. But if she doesn't, we're keeping them. We'll adopt them if it's necessary because they're in the right place to recover from the disease. So I've talked long enough. They told me I could go longer if I wanted to, but Johnny finished at an hour last night, and I want to grow up to be just like people like Johnny Harris. So I want to thank you for your kind hospitality. If you see me over the course of this weekend, I'm a hugger, not a shaker. I came to you shaken, but I hug now, and I'd be grateful to have any hugs you guys got to pass out. Thank you for letting me share.